The LARB Radio Hour is a free weekly podcast of the Los Angeles Review of Books, a reader-supported nonprofit publication. To support our continued work on this show, in print and online, please consider donating or joining as a member today at lareviewofbooks.org/radiohour.
Hello, and welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported LA Review of Books. I'm your host, Kate Wolfe, and I'm joined by my co-host, Eric Newman.
Hey, Kate. Great to see you.
You too, Eric. And this week, we're listening to an interview that you and I did with the scholar Randall Contreras about his new book, The Marvelous Ones, Drugs, Gang Violence, and Resistance in East Los Angeles.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading this. In large part because I did not know about the history of the Maravillas in Los Angeles, as well as this kind of period from the mid-90s to the mid-early aughts, I guess. So from, I believe it was 1994 to 2006, during which they were involved in a very intense war and conflict with another gang known as La M. And so learning about that was really fascinating, and also the way that the book transports you to that time. So this is a period when I obviously wasn't in Los Angeles, but this kind of violence is very constitutive of that moment in Los Angeles history, and the way in which these gangs both emerge out of a kind of history of Los Angeles and then shape that history in ways that we still kind of can touch in the present.
That's so well said. And I also find that interesting. And having grown up here, certainly the gang violence that I heard most about was the Crips versus the Bloods.
Right. That's what I was familiar with, too. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that was just one part of the city. And there was a whole other universe going on the east side. And East Los Angeles is also just a very strange place because it's not incorporated into L.A. proper. And we talk about this a little bit in the interview. Like, it wasn't even worthwhile enough for Los Angeles to annex it because the tax revenue would be so low. So it is a bit of a forgotten zone. I mean, not by the people who live there.
Of course.
In terms of city services, and it's also very vast. And yes, it's just right here, so close to where I live. So I was really interested in reading this book and also kind of reading about gang violence in a way that does not glorify it and is approaching it much more from a sociological and even psychological perspective, you know? I thought that was just, of course, a gang would be kind of like the ultimate study of masculinity and performative masculinity. You can really see it. It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing how people deal with fear.
No, absolutely. But you're also right that what also is nice about this book is that it does not sensationalize either the violence, or it doesn't feel exploitative. In other words, I think is the word that I'm really looking for, is that it feels like it's a very steady analysis of both the gang members, what motivates people to join gangs, what kind of keeps them in the gang, and then also how gang life impacts their life, both, you know, in the past and then obviously in the present and in the future.
Yeah, and it's dealing with older, current, but maybe not as active gang members. So they're way more vulnerable in their bodies and their health. And it's not quite as, you know, it doesn't have the cinematic appeal maybe of other stories of younger gang members doing death-defying things. These are people who, yeah, didn't maybe have the safety net that they thought and are now, a lot of them, living on the street. And it's a really, I think, a important study.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, let's get to that conversation.
Great.
We're thrilled to have Randall Contreras with us on the line today. Randall is an assistant professor of sociology and media and cultural studies at the University of California, Riverside. He's the author of The Stick Up Kids, Race, Drugs, Violence, and the American Dream. And he joins us today to talk about his most recent book, The Marvelous Ones, Drugs, Gang Violence, and Resistance in East Los Angeles. This latest book is a study of the past and the present of the legendary Maravilla gang that had long dominated the scene in East Los Angeles before a bitter rivalry with the La M gang network that had the Maravilla scrambling for their lives in the streets and in the prison yards from the 1990s to the early 2000s. Though centered around the experience of that epic gang war, The Marvelous Ones is also a study of how masculinity, race, and cultural identity are shaped and reshaped within the context of organized crime, both inside state institutions and outside in the everyday lives of those living in Los Angeles. It is also a story about what it means to matter and to be remembered as a man, as a husband, as a father, and as a Maravilla amid the roiling waters of political, social, and historical change. It's a pleasure to speak with you, Randall. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I thought we could start with you telling us how you found the Maravillas and why they were for you a group that you wanted to write about. How did you first learn about them? I'm curious.
I learned about them through regular talk. Like, you know, I knew people who studied gangs. I started hanging out with people who were familiar with gangs. And every now and then I would hear the name Maravilla mentioned. And so then I did an internet search on the Maravillas and I found out that they had taken this courageous stand against perhaps, you know, the most powerful prison gang in the United States. And I just became intrigued. And I always thought to myself, like, it would be fantastic if I could do research on them. But of course, you know, I'm not from LA, I'm from New York City. And so when I landed in LA, I had no connections. I was from no neighborhood because being from a neighborhood is really important in LA. I was from the Bronx. And so when people ask me where you're from, I'm like, I'm from New York City, I'm from the Bronx. So they had no context for what that meant. And so it took me about 2.5 years to actually find a gang to study. And I was fortunate to have found the Maravillas. And I found them through a colleague, actually, a French colleague who was doing research in Compton on the black and brown tension there between gang members, African-American gangs and Mexican gangs. And he had done some community work with the Maravillas in East LA, at least with the old timers, with veteranos or veteranas who were sort of not active anymore, but they still supported their community and were sort of trying to have gang members redeem themselves that were in Maravilla. And so he gave me the phone number of a director of the Maravilla Historical Society, which was based in the Maravilla Handball Court, which is it's a historic site, open air handball court where a lot of gang members used to play handball there and sort of just because in East LA, there's lots of different gangs, but they all call themselves Maravilla. So you could have like, you know, the Ford Maravilla gang. You could have the Juarez Maravilla gang, the Lopez Maravilla gang, the Arizona Maravilla gang. And they were rivals, but they would actually come to the handball court just to get together, have peace talks, you know, create truces and so forth. So the Maravilla handball court was like a unifier in the community. And so at that point, the Maravilla handball court had been criminalized because there was lots of drugs and being sold there, lots of violence happening there. And so the Maravilla old timers, at least some of them, especially the women who were used to being gangs, they were trying to rehabilitate and renovate the handball court and sort of just bring back its former glory. And so I met with the director there who was a former Maravilla gang member from their Loyo neighborhood. And I just asked her, I told her I was interested in studying the Maravillas. And I was really interested in studying the women. And she had some concerns because a lot of researchers had gone to East LA. And once they collected the data, they disappeared, never to be seen or heard again. And so she was concerned about that.
So there existed like a historical society of the Maravillas. Mm-hmm. So there is some kind of historical record within the gang that is documenting their past, or what does the historical society consist of?
There's no actual historical documentation of the Maravillas. The historical society was more about uplifting the East LA community, but they were using the Maravilla handball court as like the center, making all of that happen. And it was being run by or operated by former Maravilla gang members. Because Maravilla means marvelous in English, right? And so what a lot of people don't know is that Maravilla, East LA, parts of East LA are also called Maravilla. And so Maravilla stands for East LA in many senses, for a lot of people who came of age there between the 1950s and 1980s. And so the name has significance in the community. And so, you know, they called it the Maravilla Historical Society, but you could almost call it the East LA Historical Society.
I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about kind of the rise of Maravilla, which as you're describing also has various offshoots that are neighborhood specific, which so it has this like loose unification, right? And we'll talk about the green light period where that unification becomes more solidified. But can you kind of talk, about the rise of Maravilla and also just generally the appeal of gangs for the folks who joined it? A sense of what does a gang promise and kind of what does it deliver for its members?
Yeah, the Maravilla gangs had their origins, I would say, as far back as the 1920s. And that was a period when Mexican-Americans experienced lots of hostility, experienced lots of racism and lots of discrimination. You know, especially for the children of Mexican immigrants who were born in the United States, who felt American in many ways, but were still treated as though they didn't belong. And so a lot of those young people, they resisted by participating in these gangs, which of course started off as like just neighborhood groups, youth groups, or athletic clubs and so forth. But since they originated on a certain street, then they took the street on as their name. So, you know, if you were from or lived around Lopez Avenue, then, you know, you were part of the Lopez neighborhood and so forth. And so a lot of young people sort of joined the gang as a place to feel like they were somebody, a place that gave them meaning in a world that sort of ostracized them and so forth, especially during the 1940s and so forth, where you have what's called the Zoot Suit Riots, where you have white military men attack Zoot Suiters. And a lot of them were from the Maravilla gangs, because the white military, they actually went into these neighborhoods and they were using military jeeps and so forth. And they were entering these neighborhoods and they were just beating up anyone that had drapes or had Zoot Suits on. And a lot of these young people that were beat up were from gangs or neighborhoods, as they like to call them. That's one thing I noticed that when I was doing research, is that they hardly ever called themselves a gang. I mean, every now and then they did, but they prefer to refer to themselves as neighborhoods, which sort of gives it a more community feel. And it's non-criminalized in many ways. But every now and then they would say that they're a gang. But that's why they joined. It gave them a space to sort of thrive, a space where they could be creative, whether it was creative through dress, creative through speech, creative in terms of activity. It gave them a space, especially for young boys. It gave them a space where they could demonstrate masculinity in a world where they had few resources to demonstrate masculinity in more traditional ways, like be a traditional breadwinner and so forth, and provide, you know, resources for the family.
You know, when you described the pachuco, the figure of the pachuco, it was really fascinating to me as a style, you know, as a style that it's different. It has a dandy quality. There's an irreverence to it. It seems tied into this larger notions of subculture that we understand, but it's also a way, I think, to take some of this racism into one's own hands and kind of shape an identity that doesn't care, that is above and outside society by one's own hand, that controlling the way of dress, style, it kind of gave all this substance to style and made me understand why people want to dress a certain way as a message to white culture, especially in racist Los Angeles and immigrants coming in from Mexico, you know, in the 30s and 40s, to be different.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this is where I'll curse, right? This is like the fuck you to white mainstream society. This is, you know, that moment where they're being criminalized, they're being villainized, and they're actually adopting that identity to a degree, right? It doesn't mean that they're going to be criminal, but they're adopting that identity and saying, this is what you're saying we are, therefore we're going to embrace that label. And we're going to be creative in embracing that label. And since we don't have a space in mainstream society, we're going to create our own spaces where we shine, right? Where we're somebody, where we matter. And I would have to say that a lot of those young people are really bright and they're really smart and they just have so many skills. For instance, a lot of young people are creative in their dancing, the swing dancing of the period. And that's sort of even when you go back to the Bronx, right, with breakdancing and things like that. You know, it's almost like the young people take on the challenge and they understand that they're being oppressed. I mean, sometimes they can't verbalize it and they can't articulate what's going on, but they feel it. And they do feel that they're not part of that mainstream society. And they feel that there's divisions being set. And they have to show that they're somebody. And this is the way they do it, through the pachuco style, right? Like you mentioned, they would dress up. They would act, you know, dress up in a flamboyant way. It's almost an exaggeration of the norm, but they took on that proudly. They had this oppositional stance and this oppositional mentality, almost daring people to say something about it. But it was a way for them to also have autonomy, to have independence, and a way for them to experience dignity.
Randall, you know, it'd be interesting for you to talk about, we're talking about, you know, this kind of rise of the Pachuco, and then I'm curious about the migration to East LA. So many immigrants, when they first came here, they were coming closer to downtown, and it sounded like maybe the Zoot Suit riots changed where people felt comfortable living, or the Sleepy Lagoon incident, some movement out of Chavez Ravine, and then more and more people are heading to East LA. And some of the conditions, and, you know, gangs often start because of neglect from other resources. And it seemed like East LA was a real case study in that it was never taken on by LA City. It was never annexed because you say the tax revenue would have been too low. So it was just kind of left to languish, controlled by the county. It very much seems like another world from the way you describe it. And I was curious kind of if part of the Maravillas' rise was in relation to having not much other support.
There's not much information in terms of the historical record about what was happening during that period. So it's really hard to say whether or not any of these things sort of related to the rise of the Maravillas. And it's always hard to make these historical links. Like, it's always hard to make these connections because, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like, no one's really keeping historical records. Like, you have to rely on, like, oral histories about what happened. And even Joan Moore, who's, like, the first sociologist to study the Maravilla gangs in East LA, if you look at, if you read her book, you would see that, you know, she's relying on accounts, on the accounts of people, to sort of make connections between what happened in terms of the context and what in relationship to the rise of the Maravilla gangs. But one thing I would say that really sort of entrenched the Maravillas in East LA was heroin. During the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and even into the 50s, youth did join the Maravilla gangs, but then they sort of matured out or aged out, and they got a job, and they raised family, they got married, raised families, and so forth. And then they would just hang out in the neighborhood to drink at the local cantina or the local bar and so forth. And they pretty much lived conventional lives after that. But what happened with heroin is that it kept people on the streets, because once someone became addicted to heroin, they didn't want to get married, or they didn't find marriage as important, and raising a family wasn't as important. The drug was important. And then they would get in prison because of their drug possession, or because they were committing a crime to earn enough money to secure the drug. And then when they went to jail and prison, they had to be from somewhere. They had to be from a neighborhood, and they had to claim that neighborhood. And so it just reinforced their gang identity. And of course, the prison system doesn't really rehabilitate drug users or anything like that. So then they go back to the streets and they're still drug users, but they're still from Maravilla. They haven't drifted out, or they haven't matured out of the gang. In fact, they're stuck on the streets. And so I would argue that's one of the main factors in sort of keeping people in the gang, and then having the Maravilla gang sort of grow in number and sort of stay or remain a social institution in the community.
I just want to add here that the other thing that I imagine those gangs provide, particularly for members who have come out of the prison system, is access to literally any way to make money, because it is very, very difficult, as we all know, to get a job after you, you know, when you have that kind of time on your record. And just to kind of pitch forward a little bit, I'm curious about the kind of rise of the rival gang that's kind of the catalyst for the events of the book in the 90s, which is La M. I was really intrigued by your account of how they transformed the operation inside of prisons, and that that was the catalyst for a very radical and revolutionary takeover, basically, of gang life on the outside. So could you just talk a little bit about kind of the rise of La M and how it transformed prisons and then the world outside?
Right. If I'm going to talk about La M, I always have to be really careful with what I say.
Because we also want to talk about this later, yeah, too. The kind
even,
of
because even
of
in the book, I had to sort of frame the information I provided about them in a certain way to appear as neutral as possible. Not that I was taking any sides, but, you know, the way I wrote it was really important. But they were actually a group of Mexican-American youth during the 1950s who were sent to a juvenile detention facility in Northern California. And it was there where they saw that Mexican inmates were low in number, and they were being victimized by Black and white inmates. And so they decided to sort of form what they call the Mexican Mafia. And of course, the mafia part, that part of the name was It's sort of going along with the Italian mafias and the Irish mafias that were really popular during that period. And so they sort of saw themselves in the same vein, and they wanted to create a group, or I have to be careful here, like, but it was more of a crime group given who they were modeling themselves after. They started off with protection was their first goal in sort of in creating the group, right? They wanted to protect themselves because they were outnumbered. And then they wanted to create unity because they were strength in numbers. And so they were trying to get all the different neighborhoods or all the inmates from different neighborhoods to get together, the different Mexican neighborhoods in Los Angeles. They wanted them to unite so that they could sort of stand against the other ethnic inmates, like the white inmates and the black inmates and so forth. So that was the first goal. And they accomplished it. And they did so because they were willing to do violence. Because not all inmates, not all people can do violence, right? Only a small percentage of the population could actually engage in violence and do violence properly. And they knew how to do it. And they knew how to have people fall in line. And they would, you know, victimize inmates who didn't fall in line. They would victimize inmates who didn't agree with them. Or they would victimize inmates who didn't want to unify or come under this banner they were creating. And they were youth. And so they were brilliant. They were brilliant organizers, really creative, and just really smart. It always makes me think about how they were born under different circumstances.
Yeah.
But I can't say that morally they would have been better in any way, right? Because they could have become a CEO, but an evil CEO, right? But, you know, but they wouldn't be stuck in the criminal world.
Can you say why you have to be so careful when you talk about La M.A.?
Well, because I have to make sure that, you know, I provide the proper information. I have to make sure that I don't say anything that's out of line. I have to make sure that, you know, I'm accurate in the way I depict them, because they actually, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie American Me.
Oh, yeah. With
James Edward Olmos.
Yes, James Olmos. Yeah.
So what happened was that, you know, he sort of was part of creating this movie, American Me. And he took a lot of creative liberties in the way he depicted La M.A. So, you know, he put on film a lot of inaccurate accounts. And so, for instance, there was one account where a member of La M.A. as a juvenile was supposedly or allegedly sexually assaulted in a juvenile detention center. And that never happened. It never happened. But James Edward Olmos made it seem like it happened. And so he did other things like that in the film that got La M.A. really upset. Because, you know, as long as you're telling the truth, La M.A. is fine with it. You know, as long as it's accurate, they're fine with it. But when it's inaccurate, they're not fine with it. And allegedly, I have to say allegedly, according to some sources on the street, La M.A. then had some gang consultants to the film get killed. And again, this is what the streets are saying. This is what some newspaper accounts are saying. I'm not saying that that's what happened, but that's the story that's out there. And so there were, you know, some former gang members who actually were consultants to the film. And about two or three of them were killed because of their association with a film that fabricated the story of La M.A. or, you know, or was disingenuous with the story of La M.A.
It's interesting because you write in the book that there are so many books on gangs, or that's a footnote, I believe, you know, that mentioned how many books there are on gangs. But what keeps on coming up here is the difficulty in getting facts, documenting what actually has happened, that it really does seem like such a realm of kind of like folklore almost, that for all the documentation, there's very little real information available. It would seem that to historians, this might pose a problem, but I wonder for an ethnographer, if that was an issue for you, or really what you do is kind of meet people where they're at and document those interactions. So for your own discipline, I'm wondering, like, what this subject meant.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. When I wrote this book, of course, the story was fascinating, right? The green light against the Maravillas, their stand against La M.A. And even just, like, what's going on in their everyday lives. Like, it was all fascinating to me. But I made a decision that my job wasn't to document history. Because, again, I have to take their word for it. I'm not saying that they all conspired to sort of create a big lie about the green light or anything like that. It's impossible for people from different neighborhoods to come together and conspire against me. But I had to decide whether I was going to sort of write a book that documented who said what, where, and when, or if I was going to write a book that just talked about the meanings that they make of their experiences. And as a sociologist, I was leaning toward the latter. I can't determine whether something happened in 1964, right? You know, or their story is true or anything like that. What I could determine or evaluate is, how do they make sense of that story they're telling me? What are the meanings that they're making of it? Like, why are they telling me this? Because even if they tell me a lie, that's still valuable data, because then I could ask myself, why are they lying to me? What's in it for them by telling this lie? What does it mean? What's the big meaning of, like, of their lying? How does that make them appear as a human being? How do they want me to perceive them? So even if they lie, or, you know, there's a fabrication or a distortion, like, it's still meaningful, because I could try to get behind that and what that means for them as in terms of their status in the community, in terms of their status, you know, vis-a-vis me, right? You know, in relationship to me. But that's what I do as an ethnographer. You know, my main goal is to understand how people make meaning of their lives. Like, why do they behave the way they behave? Why do they say what they say? Why do they do what they do? Like, that's what I'm really trying to get at. Because if you look at my book, and I lay out the three questions at the beginning of the book that I always try to answer, how do people become who they are? And that's where the history comes in. That's where their biography comes in, right? Their family dynamics, their neighborhood dynamics, and so forth. And then my next question is, how do people do what they do? Because once they become who they are, they have to do what they do. And so that's when I talk about, like, let's say in this case, like, you know, how do they do gang membership? How are they gang members? How do they do violence? How do they sort of make meaning of that violence and so forth? And then the third question is, what are the consequences of who they are and of what they do? And that's usually like the end. And it's still about the meanings that they're making of various situations. Because they've told me stories over and over and over again, like the same story. I've heard these stories so many times, the same ones. But sometimes they tell it in different ways, depending on who's around, right? So it's about, like, what are they trying to accomplish in that moment by telling me what they're telling me? And so that's what my goal was. My goal was not to sort of, and I hope people, I mean, I am documenting a salient historical moment within the gang world in LA, this green light. The takeover of La M, of the gangs in Southern California, Mexican gangs in Southern California. Like, I think it has to be written about. Something has to be sort of written about how it took hold, because it did impact thousands of gang members. It dramatically transformed their lives.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. We've been speaking with Randall Contreras, author of The Marvelous Ones. We'll return to that conversation in just a moment, but first we have this week's book recommendation. I'm so glad to have Victoria Chang on the line. Victoria Chang is the author of many books of poetry, nonfiction, children's books. Her latest book of poems is called With My Back to the World, and she's here to give me a book recommendation.
Hi, it's nice to chat with you. And the book recommendation I have is actually an anthology. It's called You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World. And it's edited by our 24th Poet Laureate of the United States of America. I'm reading the cover, Ada Limón. And it's a really beautiful book that includes 50 poems that reflects on our relationship to the natural world, and has a bunch of amazing poems by people like Joy Harjo, Diane Seuss, Rigoberto Gonzalez, Jericho Brown, Amy Nizhuk-Kamotato, Paul Tran, and more.
Wow, sounds good. Tell us more. The conceit is just, these are poems that celebrate nature or speak to our global crisis of global warming.
Yeah, and I actually have a poem in there as well. Oh. And when I was asked to submit a poem, I was thinking, like, for me, I picked a poem that just had a natural landscape in it. So it was more like, not necessarily, I would say, like an eco poem necessarily, but just it was a poem that I had written when I was in Alaska. And it brings up a lot of sort of existential questions. And I think all the poems in there are very varied. I've read not all of it, but a portion of it. So I think there's just a variety of different kinds of poems in there. But it's really beautiful. I've really loved the poems I've read so far.
Does nature inspire you to write?
Oh, 100%. I always joke that I feel like I'm better friends with, like, the trees than I am with people. Like, I understand nature and feel more comfortable, like, looking at a tree. And I have very intimate relationships with certain trees and certain birds and certain aspects of nature that I sometimes feel don't I don't feel similarly about people sometimes. And so, yes, I love nature. I will constantly be walking around and stopping and looking up at things. And I'm sure people wonder, what is this person looking at? And it's just a bunch of birds that are squawking in the tree.
Wow. I think that's a great practice.
Yeah. Or the sky. I mean, I just think, yeah, people always say, just look up and your problems will be solved. I actually think that's true. It's the most incredible thing to look up and you're like, oh yeah, we're on this weird little planet. And yeah, there's also other stuff going on the opposite side of the planet right now. And it's not the same time. And it's like dark over there. So yeah. You suddenly realize how little you are. And then your problems are so little and they just don't matter. So I have to constantly remind myself not to get bogged down in the daily issues that come up.
That's it. Very true. Good thing to remember. And to help us do that, these poems, can you tell us the title of the book again and the editor?
Yeah. The title of the book is called You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World. And it's an anthology edited and introduced by Ada Limon. And it's published by Milkweed Editions.
Great. Thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
That was Victoria Chang. Her new book of poems is called With My Back to the World. You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. We now return to our conversation with Randall Contreras, author of The Marvelous Ones.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Like, so basically what happens, I'll tee it up for you, is that as you were describing earlier, Laime transforms life inside prisons. They kind of unify the prison system, and then they take the same logic to the streets. And so all these other Mexican gangs that were in this area are forced to come under the, let's say, umbrella organization, because they're actually, like you said, they're not so different really than like businesses or companies. They kind of, okay, now you're under Laime's umbrella, and Las Maravillas were the only ones to kind of refuse that. And so what I'd love to hear you talk about is both why the Maravillas refused that, and then kind of also what this green light period, so otherwise open season on any Maravilla in a prison yard, in the streets, wherever, what that meant for the folks that you were talking to who survived that period. Like, what was that like?
I mean, the reason why they refused unification under Laime was because Laime implemented rules and had regulations. Like, for instance, if you sold drugs, you had to pay a cut of the profits to Laime. So there was a drug tax involved. And also you had to put the number 13 after your gang name. And the number 13 represents the 13th letter of the alphabet, which is M. And then M is, you know, how you pronounce the letter M in Spanish. So you had to, you know, put the 13 at the end of your gang name to show your loyalty to Laime. And so the Maravillas felt that they shouldn't have to pay what they would call a rent. And they wanted to only be affiliated with Maravilla. And so that's one of the main reasons they didn't join. And they also felt that a lot of the original M members during the 1960s and 1970s actually came from Maravilla neighborhoods, because the prison gang is made up of gang members that come from various LA neighborhoods. They just happen to be the best violence doers, the best organizers, the best leaders, and so forth. They're the ones that want to rise to the top and sort of control the gang. Not every gang member wants to do that. A lot of gang members just want to go to prison and do their time and then go back home and then get back to the streets and do drugs if they're, you know, addicted to heroin, or, you know, just be with their family and see their friends and so forth. But there's a group which I would refer to as the violent elite. Their goal is to rise up to the top and sort of dominate, like what happens in the prison. And so a lot of Maravillas just felt that a small group shouldn't be able to dominate prison politics. And I think what saved Laime, what allowed them actually to resist, is that there were about 19 to 20 gangs that got together to resist Laime. Because there were other resistors. You had Opal Street, that's in Boyle Heights, they resisted Laime, but there were only one gang, one neighborhood. And they were pretty much decimated. They were like wiped out. And then you also have Lowell Street, which is in Northeast LA. And again, one neighborhood. They were wiped out. I mean, almost out of existence. I think they still exist, but it was almost like a complete, they almost don't exist. And so the benefit that Maravilla had is that the 19 neighborhoods in East LA got together. 19 or 20 neighborhoods got together and they united. So they had strength in numbers in that sense.
Is it also about geographic concentration or density, that it was also because they weren't maybe say like one member is far flung out somewhere else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were all concentrating in East LA. And also the sense of pride, because a lot of the East LA gang members, the Maravilla gang members, feel like, you know, the gang culture and gang life and the way to be a gang member started in East LA. So they had this pride, like this is where East, you know, Mexican gangsterism originated. And then you sort of couple that with how some members of La M actually were from Maravilla neighborhoods. They're like, so why is someone else going to tell us what to do? Like, we're the creators. We're the originators. We've actually produced members for you. So how dare you come to us and tell us to pay a rent, like to pay, you know, a tax on our drug profits? And, you know, it's a sense of pride, a sense of neighborhood loyalty. Because, you know, as you read in the book, most of the other gangs, I would say other Mexican gangs in Southern California, sort of caved in. But, you know, I don't want to sort of glamorize the Maravilla or say there's something special about them or anything like that. They think of themselves in that way, like we're the ones that sort of took a stand. Everyone else sort of, you know, just bowed down. That's a common phrase they use, bowing down. Like, we didn't bow down. They always say that.
Well, how did they resist in other ways beyond just not paying the tax? I mean, what did they, I hope it's not glorifying violence too much, for you to tell us a little bit about what did the green light for them consist of, and then how did they resist it in kind of physical terms?
Just to backtrack a little bit. So if a gang resisted La M, didn't sort of abide by their rules, didn't unify, then La M would put a green light out on them. And the green light meant that all the other gangs that were unified under La M, which was almost all the gangs, all the Mexican gangs in Southern California, would have to attack the resistors on site. That's what the green light meant. Whether it was in jail, whether it was in prison, whether it was on the street, they would all attack them on site. I mean, sometimes La M would have them wait for the orders before they would attack, but that's what that meant. And so when the Maravillas, they were concentrated in East LA, so it was really hard for neighborhoods surrounding East LA to go into East LA and attack them, because there were just too many neighborhoods to deal with. Where they did get attacked was in the prison system. So as soon as they were processed and they were in the jail, the Southern Mexican gangs that were under the alliance of La M, they were called the Southsiders. The Southsiders, they would attack the Maravilla gang members on site. And so if they were put in a cell, for instance, that held six inmates or six detainees, and everyone in that cell, all, you know, five of the members were Southsiders, and then you're the sole Maravilla, then you have to expect, you're expecting that you're just going to get beat up. You're going to get stomped on. You might get stabbed and so forth. And then you would have to be moved to another cell. And then you get moved to another cell. The same thing could happen all over again. And then sometimes you have to be put in protective custody, but that's something the Maravillas didn't want, because it's actually a stigma to be in protective custody, because it means that you're a coward, right? That's the way they frame it. Like, you're a coward. You couldn't stand up for yourself as a man. And you're actually making the neighborhood look bad when you go into protective custody. And also protective custody is associated with, you know, child molesters, people who do elderly abuse, people who do sexual assaults and so forth, you know, the scum of the earth, right? Like, that's the way they're framed. And so if you go into protective custody, it's like you don't mind being around the lowest of the low. Then, you know, you acquire a stigma. And then your own neighborhood could beat you up. Your own neighborhood could kill you. Your own neighborhood could, like, kick you out of the gang, right? And so they took their lumps. Like, they knew they were going to be attacked, right? It's not about if they were going to be attacked, it was about when they were going to be attacked.
But this is also a thing that I kept thinking about when I was reading your accounts of kind of the members who survived this that you were interviewing that were part of your research. I could not imagine, and maybe this is a fault of imagination, but like, I could not imagine living through what you're describing. So a state of effectively constant terror, but also like you have to then also perform like you're not afraid, right? And you have to attack back. That goes on for what, this goes from 1994 to 2006. That is 12 years of living like that. What does that do to somebody? I mean, and how does someone survive that?
Yeah, I did ask someone about, you know, how do they survive in prison under the green light? I didn't put that in the book because, you know, when you write a book, you have a word count, so you can't include everything.
Yeah.
All right. So, but the person did tell me is that they were actually prepared for it. A life of gangsterism prepared them for that because it's almost the same, you know, living in their own communities. If they're from a gang, they have to walk through other neighborhoods with rival, you know, gang members, you know, waiting to do something to them. And so they're used to people hitting them up, like asking, hitting them up means like asking what gang you're from. It's almost a statement, I would say. But they're used to people hitting them up. They're used to walking through, you know, neighborhoods where they have enemies. They're used to going to school where they have enemies as well. They're used to fighting. So, you know, even in their own neighborhoods, it's like as soon as they wake up in the morning and step out their door, they're paranoid. They're on the lookout. Like, this is a life that they're already living. I mean, it was just amplified in the jail and prison system.
It's also surprising to me, though, that this went on for so long, not least because if we think about these organizations, especially with regard to the drug trade, they're businesses, and fighting or war is bad for business. It's good for street creds, very bad for business. So, like, that is another thing that just, why did this go on for so long? And then as we kind of get to this, what do you think? And I know there's no clear answer, right? There's a bunch of different takes as to why it suddenly ends in 2006.
I think we also have to take into account how in the LA County Jail, they created a separate gang module for the Marrullas. So they were actually separating them from the main population. And I have to be careful here, right? Because it's not like going into protective custody, because the Marrullas started to fight back. The Marrullas actually started to fight, you know, attack Southsiders, do violence against them, sometimes kill them and so forth. And that's when the jail system realized that they had to do something about this. And so they created a separate gang module for the Marrullas. So if you were Marrulla, they would actually, as soon as you got processed in LA County Jail, they would put you into the Marrullas gang module. So you were away from the Southsiders, which meant that there was less likelihood of violence or victimization and so forth. So I think that slowed down the violence to a degree. But of course, when you went to the prison system, you still had to face the music, right? Like, you know, there was no separate gang module in the prison systems for the Marrullas. It was just this waiting game, like just waiting until you get attacked. Because sometimes they would go weeks without getting attacked or victimized. It was almost like a mental form of torture. You know it's going to happen, you just don't know when. People walking toward you, you don't know if they're sent to kill you. And so it's like a slow form of torture. And it also, and I didn't write this in the book because I didn't want to stigmatize certain individuals, but some, you know, some Marrullas, not all of them, and this was only a few of them, they actually abided by the rules of La M because they knew they were outnumbered. They knew that they would be killed. And I say this not to pass judgment on them. It was about survival. And I've actually had gang members, older gang members who experienced the green light tell me that, looking back, that in the moment when someone from Marrullas abided by the rules so that they wouldn't get victimized, they actually saw them as cowards. But now, you know, later on, right, looking back, it actually, for them, they're like, I don't judge them. Like, it makes a lot of sense. That's what they should have done. But also, just really quick, in terms of how the green light ended, I don't know.
Yeah, there were like at least three, I think, different possibilities that you kind of said in the book.
And I'm saying loud and clear that I don't know. There's lots of speculation. Different people have different reasons for why the green light ended. People suspect many things. But it seems as though there was a truce at some point in the prison system. But I have no knowledge of if that occurred, how it occurred or anything like that. Some people say it was because some Marrullas started dealing drugs with La M. And that sort of helped lift the green light up, or some Marrullas joined La M and, you know, they were able to take the green light off at least their neighborhoods. But I don't know. I really don't know. It just stopped.
The way that you write about Marrullas remembering this time is kind of like a time of glory. They feel like the pain that they suffered helps to make their worth, that they went through this awful thing. They showed bravery. And in some sense, the violence perpetuates because it's not remembered like in war. People don't come back and think, God, what a waste. That wasn't worth anything. Instead, they feel pride that they endured something. And you also write about violence as not in this context necessarily like sociopathic behavior, that it is a way for people to show their love like for their kin and their neighborhood. And that you say that violence can be supported by a social network. It's not going against that social network as we often think of it. It's booing it. So I thought that that's, you know, a real interesting point in just why and how would violence end in this situation? I mean, we can see it continuing, and that these people, as they get older, you're talking to mostly older people, this is the thing that really defined their lives and made them feel like they matter. So they kind of pass it on to the next generation of like, this was the time.
Yeah, it's almost as though if you did a lot of violence in prison, especially in terms of protecting the Maravillas from the Southsiders or La M, you were a superstar. It was like Hollywood for them. And so the point I was trying to make is that sometimes we look at people who do extraordinary violence as like being sociopathic, like there's something mentally wrong with them, as though they're monsters and so forth. But the reason why they do this is because they're being supported by the social. They're being supported by the group. The reason why they do such horrific violence is because they're doing it for the gang. And then the gang recognizes that and the gang lauds that. The gang praises them. The gang sort of puts them into positions of leadership or treat them with lots of respect and gives them a higher status. And so that's why that type of violence continues. But not everyone can do that violence. Not every gang member could do extreme violence. It's usually what I call, or what Randall Collins, a sociologist, would call the violent elite. And then in this case, it was a group called the Marvelous Ones or the Maravillosos. And they took it upon themselves. They recruited themselves to protect the Maravilla gangs from La M. And so they had to perform violence. They had to stab people. They had to kill people. They had to be willing to die for the group. And they had to be willing to put themselves in dangerous situations. Like, they almost embraced violence, right? It's almost as though they didn't care about their lives, that the group was more important than them. And this is what had people actually, this is what made them feel good about themselves, because then they got lots of support from the community. It was almost religious, right? They got lots of support. And I talk a lot about emotions in the book, and it's because a lot of research doesn't acknowledge emotions. The reason they do this violence is because it makes them feel good afterward. And, you know, and it makes them feel good for mainly two reasons. It makes them feel good, one, because they're able to sort of overcome the tension and fear that's required or that people feel while they're ready to do violence. And not everyone can do that. And so then once they accomplish violence, they get over that fear of doing it. It's like an emotional high. They feel exhilarated. And two, they get lots of emotional support from their community, from the people that they're protecting. And so, you know, it's almost religious in a sense, like you have people surrounding you who are praising you, who feel emotionally uplifted. And that uplifts you too. And so it makes you want to keep doing it because it just feels so good.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the afterlives of the Maravillas. So you have a very, and I don't want to give it away, but it is like kind of a tragic ending for one of your research subjects at the end. But it did seem like as a group, these men and women who had suffered a lot, you know, had been through a lot. In some ways, it feels like there's like a lack of cultural memory or some long, like that in some ways they were put back into lives that had been at once like kind of family relationships and other relationships that had been broken by their experience in the gang or their experience with drugs, but also in a world that just no longer really gave them the kind of dignity or respect that they had been fighting for basically their entire lives. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that. And also, I was surprised that I had never heard of Maravilla before. And that's, there's a number of different reasons for that. But if we're thinking about the kind of 90s, what I remember, I know a whole lot more than I probably otherwise would know about like the Crips and the Bloods, because they had this kind of national attention, which was both because of the way that those gang stories percolated up into hip hop music, for example, that kind of gave it national reach to like a kid in the suburbs, like myself of Kentucky. So can you talk a little bit about kind of, as you mentioned at the top, telling this story is important, remembering these people and this history is important. And why is it that we kind of haven't necessarily remembered that history?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think, you know, like we were talking about the violence earlier, right? A lot of the violence that they committed sort of made them feel like they mattered in the world. They might not have mattered to mainstream people that much. They might have been seen as a scourge or as seen as horrible human beings and so forth. But within their gang community, they became somebody. They got lots of prestige in a world where they would otherwise wouldn't get that same prestige. And that became a theme. And so I think the tension was that while they mattered in the gang world, they didn't matter outside the gang world. And they were constantly fighting to be somebody, to be acknowledged, to be loved, to be recognized outside of the gang community. They wanted to be loved. They wanted to be special in their family. They wanted to be loved and feel special in like the East LA community generally. And so they encountered all these problems, especially in a world that was changing. Like for instance, you know, in East LA, you know, there are a lot of Mexican immigrants moving into the community. And culturally, they were, I don't want to use the word dominating, because there's always like conflict involved with that, or as though there's like, you know, a takeover going on. But, you know, Mexican culture, Mexican immigrant culture just became prevalent in that space. And the Maravillas felt that Chicano culture, right, because they consider themselves Chicano. And by Chicano, they probably mean Mexican-American, even though Chicano has a political identity. But they didn't call themselves Chicano because of the political aspects of the identity, but more because they were born in the country. They felt that as Chicanos, they were being pushed out in terms of music, in terms of dress style, in terms of language, and so forth. So they felt like they no longer mattered in East LA. And so, you know, this is when they become racist toward Mexican immigrants, even though they themselves are of Mexican origin. And this is when they start supporting, not all of them, I can't say all of them, but a lot of them started to support Donald Trump because Donald Trump had this anti-immigrant message. And it sort of resonated with the way they felt about Mexican immigrants in their communities because they still wanted to matter within their communities. In terms of race, I mean, a lot of them were racist. And a lot of their racism comes from their experiences in prison where there's ethnic divides. And so, you know, they bring that with them to the streets. Because you would ask yourself, you know, East LA is a community that's made up of most about, you know, 95% Latinos. There's hardly any Black, well, now there's more Black people moving into the neighborhood, Black residents moving into the neighborhood, but they hardly have any encounters with Black people. And you would ask yourself, why are they racist against Black people? Like, they can't really point to any negative interaction with Black people within their community. But it's because of their interactions with Black people in the prison system. Like, they're taught in the prison system, as soon as they go in, that they're the enemy. And they're sort of fed these ideas that Black people are culturally backward, that they're, you know, socialized to be sexual predator, like all these things, right? And so then they're starting to see more Black residents move into East LA. They're starting to see that their own children are having relationships with Black people, intimate relationships with Black people. And so they have to reconcile this, like, you know, where do they fit in into all of this? Where do they fit into, you know, these progressive ideas or these progressive movements? And they still want to matter because as Chicano, they feel that they're just not mattering anymore. Like, you know, their ideas don't matter. Their presence doesn't matter. And this is when they start going down this spiral of self-destruction. At least some of them do. I mean, some of them go into religion.
Yeah. You had a number that kind of embrace the Pentecostal faith, for example.
Exactly. And so that sort of lifts their spirits and they feel like they matter to God and to the religious community. But some of them are borderline Christians, right? That they sort of never go completely into religion. They still have one foot on the streets. And with all this change happening, I mean, they have to revert to what made them matter in the past, and that's through violence. And so, you know, they have to do street violence to sort of still be somebody, to still be respected. And some of them, especially with the COVID crisis, COVID pandemic, you know, they just feel like they just matter no more because of the isolation that they experienced. Like, they're not around other people anymore. They can't sort of create that human interaction that's needed to feel that, you know, you're connected to something larger than yourselves. And that just leads to terrible outcomes. In terms of why we've never heard of the Maravillas, I think because, you know, there have been films about gangs in East LA, but they never really named the Maravillas specifically. And I think a lot of it has to do with gang politics. Gang members aren't supposed to talk to journalists, at least if you're under the Southsider umbrella. So you could talk about things generally, but you can never really give specifics. And so I think it's just really hard to get information out about, you know, Mexican gangs in Southern California. I mean, because even when information is given, it's usually very abstract type information, like information you could just find on the internet. Like, you'll never really get detailed information about specific things. And I think people are operating out of fear in that sense. It could get some people killed if you're a gang member. Theoretically, if you're a gang member, it could get you killed. And so I think that's why there's not more talk about it. I mean, even the movie Blood In, Blood Out, it called the Southsiders in Miami. They didn't call it those names. They called it La Onda in the movie. And I think people are just being really careful. And I get it. I completely get it. Like, is your life worth it? Are you willing to risk your life just to give this type of information? And so I think that's why. And also, I think racism played a large role too. The black gangster in the popular imagination, right? The criminal. I mean, this is something that gets headlines. And it sort of was one more thing that conservative politicians could point to and see, like, this is the way black people are. This is why we shouldn't support them, right? They're doing it to themselves. They're killing themselves. There's something wrong with black culture, right? It sort of supported all those arguments. And so I think that's why we heard more and more about it. And NWA, of course, that rap group.
Yeah.
They popularized gangster rap.
I'm wondering, I really don't think this book takes a moralistic stance. It's kind of amazing that for a book that depicts so much violence, I really came away from it with a sense of the vulnerability of a lot of the people that you write about. And the really, like, the performance of masculinity and how much of an armor it is. I mean, obviously, but really it was very clear in this book. And I'm wondering if there is anything you would want a reader to kind of understand about the plight of these men and how vulnerable they actually are.
There's always the danger whenever you write about violence and you write about drug use or drug markets and things like that, that the reader comes away criminalizing the people that you wrote about, or you possibly can reinforce negative stereotypes about a marginal group or marginal community. And that's one thing. I don't want that to be the takeaway. And that's why I take the approach that I take, like, you know, how do people become who they are? And I talk about history and I talk about neighborhood dynamics and family dynamics and so forth. And I always talk about, you know, the consequences, whether good or bad, for what they do. And so for me, the big takeaway would be that these men aren't social monsters, that there's a reason why they did violence in the past, and there's social reasons for why they do what they do, and that they're just human beings just like everyone else. You know, they have hopes, they have dreams, they have vulnerabilities, and they do recognize those things. And I just wanted to give a human face to the struggles that, and they're a forgotten group of people. Like, everyone always pays attention to the young gangsters, right? The young kids, especially young men who are doing violence, getting caught up in drugs and drug dealing and so forth. But what happens to them when they get older? They're usually forgotten. They're put away. And then the new generation of youngsters are analyzed and studied and talked about and put on the media and all that. And then you have these aging gangsters who are suffering, and they spent their prime years pretty much on a path towards self-destruction. But of course, the social does matter, right? We have to look at what's going on in the economy. We have to look at unemployment. Like, we have to look at all those things to sort of, because that's what really shapes and influences the lives of people. Because when I think about the manufacturing sector, which was thriving in LA during the 1960s, but then toward the end of the 1960s and 1970s, the manufacturing sector started to decline. And so those spaces weren't there for young minority men in LA. And those jobs provided lots of benefits. They provided, you know, lots of stability. They provided wages that allowed families to save money and so forth, and, you know, create generational wealth and all of that. But that was gone, right? For minority groups, that was gone. Like, white groups, white ethnic groups were able to take advantage of that during the early part of the 20th century and sort of experience, you know, upward mobility. But once the manufacturing sector declined, like, those opportunities were gone. And so then you have to ask yourself, like, you know, it seems like there's this relationship between the decline of manufacturing and the rise of gang membership, because gang membership exploded during the 1970s. It's just because there were no more spaces where young men could feel dignified as men. And so I just want to sort of just give almost like a life course history of the lives of the study participants so that people could see that they've had lots of struggles throughout their lives. Like, for instance, there was one participant whose mom injected him with heroin for the first time when he was 13 years old. What do you expect after that?
Right.
Yeah.
Completely. Well,
unfortunately, I think we have to end it there. But what is wonderful is kind of the way in which the research that you've done for this book, it really does make their stories matter. And it gives their stories a kind of broader audience so that this history isn't, like we've been talking about, it isn't lost, that their lives do matter and that we can think about how those lives are shaped and reproduced across history. So thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Randall Contreras, author of The Marvelous Ones, Drugs, Gang Violence, and Resistance in East Los Angeles. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate us on Apple Podcasts to help us get the word out. And we'd love to hear from you. The producers at the LARB Radio Hour are Medea Ocher, Kate Wolf, and Eric Newman. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky. Our sound engineer is Matea Baim. Editorial production by Jake Levins. Our intro music was written and performed by Imogen Teasley Vlotten.